Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Common Sense with Dr. Ben Carson. I'm your host, Ben Carson, and we're going to have a very interesting talk today. We have Eric Patterson. He's the president of the Religious Freedom Institute. We certainly need to be talking about religious freedom these days. And Dr. Patterson is the past dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University and a research fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. And we're going to be discussing some of the complex issues of medical conscience rights against a backdrop of societal changes and cultural changes, and how the Religious Freedom Institute is working toward recognizing religious liberty as a fundamental human right. So, Eric, thank you so much for taking time out to join us today to discuss this very important topic.
Dr. Carson, you're welcome. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Well, first thing I want to ask you, tell me, what exactly is the Religious Freedom Institute and why has this become such a big issue in a country where the First Amendment deals with religious freedom?
Yeah. So at the Religious Freedom Institute, we are a nonprofit, a kind of a think and do tank, if you will, here in Washington, D.C., with people across the country and some of our employees abroad. And we work to secure religious freedom for everyone, everywhere. And we do that largely through education and advocacy. We have high school and college training programs. We do military chaplains training. We provide resources on Capitol Hill and in state legislatures to understand the religious freedom dimensions of different issues, whether it's parental rights, if it's choices in education, if it's medical conscience, if it is these new Title IX issues where people are trying to be told that they have to act outside of their religious convictions, and of course, persecution of Christians and others at home and abroad. And of course, it really is, we do live in a time where there's truly a crisis of religious liberty growing in our own country, where people have deeply held religious convictions in their business, in their academic life, as parents. They're told, you know, those traditionally held, those scripturally held, those religious values, you cannot bring them with you any longer on issues of life, marriage, what goes into the school library for your second grader, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're at a time where defending religious freedom and frankly, re-explaining it is crucial to our democracy.
Absolutely. And, you know, let's talk about some of the specific areas, like assisted suicide and euthanasia. You know, Canada in 2016 made euthanasia legal for people 18 years old and older, and then expanded it to those suffering from a grievous and irremediable condition where death is not reasonably foreseeable. And come March of this year, it's going to be including people with mental illness. And that to me is very concerning because when I look back at the congressional record here, 60 years ago, when they were reading in some of the goals of those who want to fundamentally change our society, mainly communists, says transfer some of the powers of arrest from the police to social agencies. Treat all behavioral problems as psychiatric disorders, which no one but psychiatrists can understand and treat. Dominate the psychiatric profession and use mental health laws as a means of gaining coercive control over those who oppose communist goals. You know, if we start tying mental health and we have government defining who's mentally healthy and what should be done with them, we got a real problem on our hands. It's setting the stage for some pretty awful things. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. A little good news from Canada, and then the bad news. It looks like I just was briefed by our senior fellow, Andrew Bennett, who's based in Canada yesterday. It looks like they may have bumped back because of some opposition. The next phase, that March phase, perhaps tabled it until a vote in the summer because there's finally been some resistance on this. But this so-called Medical Assistance in Dying Act, they call it MAID in Canada, is really frightening. You know, they're killing largely through physician-assisted suicide. In other words, the medical community essentially pressing the button. 13,000 people a year, 4.1% of the deaths in Canada. And to just give you kind of a sense, in 2016, Canada passed that law. And unfortunately, the state of California passed a similar law. Canada, 13,000 people in 2022, California, 800. And so the scale, and the reason I mention those two is not because they both start with a CA, but because they're actually similar in population size. So Canada is killing its own elderly and its own people who are very, very vulnerable at a huge rate. And what it makes it very difficult from a religious freedom perspective is this: the nurse, the medical assistant, the anesthesiologist, the doctor, the mental health professional who does not want to participate in these things, but has the coercive power of socialized medicine arrayed against them when they know that ending life prematurely in this way is wrong.
Absolutely. And it tends to spread. There was one woman in Canada who submitted an application for assisted death who was suffering from long COVID. And she said it affected her profession and her quality of life and her financial situation, and therefore she needed to die. I mean, where in the world does that end? But is there a distinction between euthanasia and assisted suicide?
Well, I think that there's some gradients here that particularly the defenders of these types of things like to hide behind. Medical assistance in dying sounds so beautiful, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It sounds like some sort of palliative care, being taken care of very, very carefully. Right. But these things happen extremely quickly. And again, most of the cases are physician assisted. In other words, there's medical professionals. And it's a very quick process that just takes a few minutes from the consent. If someone signs off consent to do this as the patient with a family member there, it can all be over in under 10 minutes. It's an immediate and a vast injection of these lethal toxins. And so hiding behind a variety of euphemisms, what this really is it's a physician assistant death. It's a type of murder where we're killing off some of our most vulnerable people in our society. I mean, ironically, what should we do with the elderly? We should take very good care of them. And instead, what it seems like in Canada is that they're too costly for the medical system. So they're being told, you know, you're not really valuable. We need to save the dollars on you for your grandchildren. Right. And then they bump them off. It's chilling.
Sort of the way things started out in Nazi Germany, isn't it?
It is.
Very similar when you stop and think about it. First, it was just the people who were very, very infirm. And then it was the older people, and then it just kept expanding and expanding.
How about you, just that distinction between these different labels, euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, et cetera, How do you find them, if you don't mind my asking you?
Well, physician-assisted suicide seems to me much worse. Euthanasia is bad enough as it is. I remember the first time I heard that term, I was in high school, and I was saying, why are people talking about the youth in Asia? But, you know, I think when I think about euthanasia, I think about a very broad category of people who are uncomfortable and are in the end stages of their life, and they're going to die anyway. Mm-hmm. And you're just speeding that along. Whereas when I think about a physician-assisted suicide, I think more people who may not have been dying anyway, but who feel that their life is so miserable that they would rather be dead than to continue that life.
You know, picking up on that point that you've just made, some of the places in Europe, particularly Belgium, have dramatically expanded these laws under a label of compassion. But what's mm-hmm. happening, for instance, is they've extended it to children. And so it sounds, oh, so a child who's suffering terribly with egregious pain, and by implication that they'd probably die very soon, could choose mm-hmm. this path. You unpack that, and a 10-year-old. What's our responsibility as a society, as the medical profession, as a community, and as parents, to provide palliative care to a child and be seeking restoration and healing, rather than allowing a child? There's so many things we don't let them vote at that age, but let them make a choice about death. And who's going to counsel them that they should make a choice to kill themselves at a tender age because of true suffering and pain that they're feeling? Right. It really is an insidious. We're not protecting them by those laws.
Well, in the old days, we used to spend a lot of time concentrating on how do we improve people's lives and how do we prolong people's lives. Now we're talking about physician-assisted suicide and abortion. And it comes down, I think, to a disrespect for human life and just not valuing who people really are. But what kind of things motivate people to seek assisted suicide? What are the common reasons?
Yeah, there's a variety of reasons. And in so many of the cases that we see, it does have to do with the prospect of lingering illness, lingering pain, and these types of things. But that can happen quite prematurely with someone, as you mentioned, who has extreme anxiety or depression, but is much mm-hmm. younger, is much more physically vital and healthy. And so what we need to be looking for are paths towards health, paths towards mental health care, late in life, paths towards palliative care to ease suffering, but not to end life prematurely. Again, from a religious freedom perspective, there's really at least two elements. One is clearly these types of arguments say that the religious sentiments of so many people are just not there when we focus them on these questions. In other words, we no longer value as that person made in the image of God, whether it's an unborn child or an old person. They're just an expendable entity. Mm-hmm. And then second is the coercive nature of asking the anesthesiologist, the nurse, the medical assistant, the physician, or the mental health professional to be complicit in this evolving culture of death that says that these lives are not precious, but expendable. Against maybe their religious convictions. Particularly, I think about so many nurses who are people of deep faith being pulled in complicit right. into these types of procedures.
Right. And they don't really have a choice. I mean, they're assigned to that case. They're not asked, would they like to be involved in that case? And that's a real problem. There's no question about it. But also, when it comes to transgenderism, and participating in those kinds of surgeries, you know, the nursing staff is assigned to the operating room where this is going to occur. The anesthesiologist is assigned to that case. And, you know, the decision has already been made by those who are performing the surgery and some of the others. And the others are put in an extremely uncomfortable position. I would imagine that some of those people probably come to your institute looking for help.
Yeah, that's right. There's both the individual level of this, and then there's the structural or the institutional level. And I'll just mention a famous case that one of our allies is litigating in the courts. It's made the news. Valerie Klusterman, a 17-year career as a physician's assistant in Michigan, great reviews by her patients. She's a Christian. She works under the Hippocratic Oath, and her love of every human being is created in the image of God. And but it was DEI training, this diversity, equity, inclusion training, that forced her to answer either untruthfully or stand by her religious convictions on questions that asked her to affirm that she would use preferred pronouns that violate the sexual reality or the gender reality of a patient. And she said she would not do it in the training course. She was then counseled, a better word would be bullied or harassed by staff, by this DEI staff who called her evil, who bullied her and harassed her. She ultimately lost her job, even though this was all hypothetical. There was no patient violated. There was no patient who complained. It all happened under the auspices, frankly, of the brainwashing of this new ideology in HR training. I believe that she will be vindicated, and many, many others will. But this is where it's not just the individual, but it's an insidious insertion of these anti-faith, anti-religious freedom ideologies in accreditation, licensure, training, and in HR departments through DEI and other things.
Right. Well, it's not far away from the re-education camps that the communists use. If you disagree with them, you're off to the re-education camp, and you're going to stay there until you agree with them, mm-hmm. which sometimes is a life sentence for some people. I hope we never see anything like that in this country, but we're laying the groundwork for it right now. But why do you think that transgenderism is increasing so rapidly? I mean, it used to be like 0.03% of the population, and now you probably saw the article at Brown University, 40% of the students identify as LGBT in some way. I mean, that can't be a true physiological phenomenon. That's got to be peer pressure.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of writing on this topic. Some well-known books, on the one hand, who show kind of a social contagion going on, and it of not just confusion, but kind of faddism. On the one hand, particularly among young women. There's also research by Jonathan Haidt and others about the way this social contagion has spread through the use of the hyperactive use of social media in our society. But I think at its heart, one of the things that we've lost and is this sense that we've lost a sense in our society of the reality of the beauty of the male and the beauty of the female, the beauty of the family where they come together. And instead, we've created, as Carl Truman and many others have written about, a society that says, no, create your own reality. Reality is flexible. It's malleable. You create your own reality. And in fact, you'll score points if you do something exotic, if you do something out of the norm, if you kind of rebel against whatever the expectations are from your parents. And all of that pressure and all of the kind of opportunity there is, I think, is creating an opportunity for quite a bit of confusion and experimentation. Mm-hmm. And what most studies tell us is that if we help those young people through this time with keeping the guardrails on in a loving, winsome way, with perhaps counseling, with good role models in the home and in society, with positive but profound teaching in our churches and houses of worship, that those young people in almost every case will come through their teen years and be fully rooted in the gender identity that God created them in their natural male or female sexuality.
Exactly. And, you know, those who are advocating and pushing this transgender agenda, they're the same ones who like to talk about follow the science. Well, the science is pretty clear. Two X chromosomes, you're female. X and a Y, you're male. That's straightforward. And also, thinking about the development of the brain, which starts right after conception and continues well beyond birth. At the time that a baby is born, his brain is rapidly developing. That's why babies sleep 20 to 24, or at least 22 hours out of the 24-hour cycle. But that brain continues to develop until the mid to late 20s. And why would you be thrusting upon an undeveloped brain expectations of complex social issues like gender? That's why they have parents to protect them from people who prey upon this undeveloped brain. And when you look at how many of them end up in serious psychological situations because they made a wrong decision, it really is very troublesome. But it's just as troublesome that we force people to get involved in doing that. And the medical practitioners who have conscientious objections to getting involved with those kinds of treatments, what recourse do they have? Lawsuit, resigned, is there anything else they can do?
Yeah, well, if you think about the pipeline on this, it's very troubling, because many, many medical schools, this stuff starts with signing an affidavit that you will participate, for instance, in abortions, that you're willing to participate in these types of procedures. In other words, we're increasingly seeing at many medical schools, there's a gatekeeping happening where you're asked to affirm that you will participate as part of your training in these types of things. And then through the periods of residency and these types of things, undoubtedly more and more we will see people being pulled into those procedures, frankly, making them complicit early on. And so what are those steps? Never enter the profession, leave the profession, go into parts of the medical establishment where you don't think that you'd ever have to do that. Become a veterinarian, become an eye doctor or something. And I'm not making fun. I mean, clearly these types of things in a profession are designed to exclude people. And then of course, lawsuit. So someone who's attacked, who's already in the profession and they're attacked professionally. Valerie Clustermann, or I think about Regina Frost, OBGYN from New York, and her famous case. The recourse that they've had to take is to resort to lawsuits. But one thing we can do in America, and we're doing it here at RFI with allies, is to protect the rights of those people through medical conscience rights legislation. We've seen this pass in five U.S. states. RFI, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and others have an alliance on this. We'll see five new state legislatures vote on legislation protecting the medical conscience rights of patients, but also practitioners later this year. And that's one of the things we can do, not leave it simply to the courts, but protect these rights in law, in state codes, and over time, inform people and change the culture in such a way that we protect this at the national level as well.
That's a very good point. We will be right back in 1 minute with Eric Patterson.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping Dogs Lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with more Common Sense with Dr. Eric Patterson. We've been talking about some very interesting issues here. He's the president of the Religious Freedom Institute. You know, I'm just flabbergasted by all the things that are happening in our society right now. Do you think this is having an impact on students who want to go into the medical profession? Are they looking at some of these kinds of issues and maybe saying, I'll do something else?
I do think that this is affecting young people because, for instance, we see many undergraduates through our statesmanship and religious freedom seminars that we run in Washington, Philadelphia, London, and other places. We also have an internship program. So between that and speaking on 8 to 10 college campuses a year, I spend a lot of time with students. And increasingly, the types of questions that I hear from students, I've always heard faith, you know, students of faith ask the question, you know, can I be a faithful Muslim? Can I be a faithful Christian and do such and such a profession, you know, go into politics or be a lawyer, et cetera? That, you know, they've heard that some professions are you have to make moral compromises. But, I used to never hear that about the medical profession. I used to never hear someone say, you know, what I really wanted to do was I really want to be a physician's assistant, or I want to be a medical doctor. I want to be a brain surgeon. But can I do that anymore? Or am I going to be pulled in and be forced to perform an abortion or to be complicit in trying to change a girl into a boy, or God forbid, have to participate in killing off an older adult? Can I go into this profession anymore? Now, I don't hear it a lot, but I do hear those types of questions. And I do think that our thoughtful young people are worried, and they're worried for good reason, because they may have older brothers and sisters or cousins or friends who have been attacked through the process of entry into medical school on their religious convictions. Or they may have a family member who has had one of those types of experience. They have an older sister who's a nurse or something of that nature. Mm-hmm. And so there is a chilling effect. And what does that do? It pushes good people out of these wonderful professions. Absolutely. For healing and care.
Well, it's such a difficult position to be in. But I always encourage people to push back. Mm-hmm. Don't just capitulate and give in. And fight back with logical arguments. You know, when it comes to abortion, and they say it's just a meaningless bunch of cells, it's not a real human being. Why is it then that when somebody murders a pregnant female, they get charged with 2 counts of murder?
That's right.
So if it's a meaningless bunch of cells, that doesn't make any sense at all. And I don't think people really stop and think very much about those kinds of things. But the current administration, the federal government and HHS under this administration, it seems like they've targeted religion and healthcare. Have they, in your opinion, worked to limit religious freedom and consciousness rights?
Absolutely. We're so grateful for the work that you did during your time of government service in the previous administration, and the wonderful team that you assembled that was fighting to protect the conscience rights of practitioners, of parents, of patients. All of this was very, very, very important work during this crucial time. And there's been efforts really across the board in the medical space, but in other spaces as well, to roll back conscientious objection by parents, conscientious objection by medical and mental health practitioners, and just a whole variety of areas. So one of them is a new set of agency rules that were just published about 2 weeks ago by HHS on specifically on the matters that we're talking about eliminating religious convictions and other conscience objections to participating in a variety of things. Right. We've seen this in other spaces, such as the advice to schools, both in the Obama administration, but also in the Biden administration, these kind of letters that come from the Department of Education, basically telling schools, we're going to go in this direction when it comes to Title IX, for instance, and we're going to look towards a wider category of no longer protecting women and women's sports, but redefine that so that boys can compete against girls. We've seen it in this administration with their advocacy of the so-called Equality Act, which would ban the opportunity for religious exemptions under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act for people for religious organizations, for faith-based institutions, et cetera, when it comes to these types of issues like transgender and sexual orientation and gender ideology. Mm-hmm. In other words, that it would make these categories new civil rights, and even a house of worship or a religious organization couldn't say, no, we're not going to hire that person. No, we wouldn't do a marriage, et cetera, because it's against our fundamental religious convictions, which we all know are protected by the First Amendment and then in the subsequent laws like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But the so-called Equality Act and other elements, it strips all of that away. In a sense, right. it's a profound violation of religious liberty and religious conviction.
Well, maybe we ought to throw it back in their faces. They say, I can declare myself a member of the opposite sex because that's the way I feel deep inside of me. Mm-hmm. And you can't really dispute that. Well, I'm thinking about this situation in Boston over Christmas where the mayor had a party and said that no white people are invited. Do you remember hearing about that? Mm-hmm. I wish a bunch of white people had gone to the party and said, we identify as black today. What would the woke folks say about that? They're completely illogical, obviously, in the way that they do things. And when you bring these things up to them, they generally resort to calling you names. But with the federal government seemingly so determined to force this kind of thinking on the population, what can the states do themselves? Or do they have to comply with these federal edicts?
Well, what's been great is we have seen courageous governors in places like Texas and especially Florida just say no. We've seen other times where there's really been waffling on some of these types of issues, saying, well, we'll lose NCAA revenue, for instance. And so we've had disappointments in recent years in places where we didn't expect it, for instance, South Dakota at times, where we really thought that there'd just be from the beginning forward a resolute stand against violations of Title IX, violations of medical conscience rights, the violations of girl athletes being protected in the locker room and on the playing field, the rights of parents to make decisions. But we have seen in places like Florida, Governor DeSantis say, this stuff is insane and that we're not going to do this. We've seen the legislature in Florida be sane and say, we're going to protect the rights of children. We're going to protect the rights of families. We're going to protect the rights of school teachers, et cetera. And so there's a lot that can be done. We need active voting. We need parents standing up in terms of the responsibilities for what's best for their children. We need pastors, priests, and other religious leaders to be explicit, not about partisanship, but about reality. and mm-hmm. what that means in our society. And that compassion means telling the truth and not giving way to lies. And we need state legislatures in particular to be defending these rights in their state codes. And of course, what will help us over time is to have people who affirm reality and affirm truth in Washington protecting those things as well.
Absolutely. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be back in 1 minute with some closing comments from Dr. Eric Patterson.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back with final segment here. And this has been a fascinating discussion. But, you know, one of the things that is clear is that if we are going to have a free society where people are able to live based on their religious convictions, it requires courage. You can't just sort of sit in a corner and hope that everything is going to be okay. You really cannot be the land of the free if you're not the home of the brave. And that means taking a stand. I think a lot of pastors, ministers, really need to think about this too. I see so many churches trying to remold themselves so that they fit into the wake ideology. That's not what should be done. The churches should be the ones who draw the line in the sand and saying, this is the word of God. This is what we believe. And when they begin to compromise on that, then it makes it easy for the congregation to compromise. It makes it easy for the society to compromise. And when Alexis de Tocqueville came to America in 1831 to study us, you know, the thing that he was most impressed by were the sermons that were coming from those pulpits, which gave the people a moral foundation, which encouraged the military, a bunch of ragtag militiamen, to defeat the most powerful military force on earth. You know, our values, our morals, are a big part of the incredible success that this country has had. And if we throw them away, if we don't protect them for our fellow Americans, we will definitely lose them. So I want to ask you, how can people get involved with RFI?
I just want to affirm the things that you just said. And, you know, you started this broadcast with that by noting how much this feels like the old communist approach. The old communist approach was, there's no such thing as human nature. We, the elite, will control you, and we will shape men and women into our own image. Mm-hmm. It's the ultimate lie, right? It's incredibly narcissistic. It's incredibly elitist. And it's that same framework, frankly, that we're hearing today. And so it's deeply worrying because it's a direct assault on a fundamental moral order that is rooted first in the beauty of humanity created in the image of God. and the basic understanding of natural law and the golden rule. All of this is out the window when it's elites who can impose using state coercion and social hostility. Mm-hmm. And so what can be done today? Well, of course, we'd love for people to come to our website, thereligiousfreedominstitute.org, read our materials, look for a way to help us to run student programs in your own states or city or community. Look at our medical conscience rights initiative and ways to support organizations like us and others who are educating lawmakers on the ways that they can protect their own citizens and their states. By the way, I hear a lot about pluralism and diversity. Don't we want to have a medical profession that is as diverse as our communities? Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't we want to protect and to advance the Muslim doctor, the Muslim female doctor, who's going to care within her own faith tradition for other Muslim women? Or the Catholic doctor who would not prescribe contraceptives because it's against religious convictions. We have millions of Catholics in America. That's the kind of healthcare that they want. That's real pluralism. That's real diversity. And there's a variety of other ways for people to get involved as well. They really do need to let their pastors know, their communities know, their friends know that they're going to stand for their moral beliefs, their religious convictions, absolutely, and how they do business, the choices that they make for their family, and the ways that they vote for our country. And finally, of course, we need prayer.
Absolutely. Take a stand. Stand up for what you believe in. And America will be strong, and our best days will be ahead of us. Don't be afraid. Fear not, for God is still in charge. And what does it say in our pledge? One nation under God.
We That's
shouldn't
right.
just let those tongue, let those words roll off our tongue. We should think about what they mean. Mm-hmm. And it was not a coincidence that we went from nowhere to the pinnacle of the world in record time. And we need not throw away those things that allowed us to get there.
Dr. Carson, can I just say, when people say the pledge, they need to say those four words together loudly. One nation under God. They shouldn't pause. It's not two phrases. It's one phrase. And it's pretty amazing when we start saying it like that in public assemblies. One nation under God. No breaks. At first, your own voice just kind of is a loudspeaker by yourself. But people will catch on. It is one nation under God. It's not one nation under God, indivisible. And it's very important to realize that e pluribus unum, out of many one, the vision of the founding fathers that we've been working on and trying to perfect, is a unified nation, beautiful and diverse, a melting pot, but it's one nation under God. We're all equal that way. That's where our moral and political equality comes from, is that recognition that we're all equal under God.
That is a beautiful thought. And remember what Alexis de Tocqueville said at the end of his books. He said, America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, she will cease to be great. It's our job to make sure that she stays good.
That's
and you're
right.
doing your part, and we appreciate it very much. Thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, and thanks for this opportunity to chat with you today.
Okay. And we'll be back with my closing prescription in 1 minute.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hope you enjoyed that session with Dr. Eric Patterson. You know, there's so many medical practitioners who are in a quandary. They believe in life. They respect life. They believe in real science. Their whole profession was built around science. And now they're asked to do things that are antithetical to their beliefs and to their teachings. My assignment for you this week, support those people so that they have the courage to stand up for their convictions and not just be steamrolled into doing what everybody else is doing. There is such a thing as right and wrong. It's not your right and my right. It's the right. It's what's right. And we need to understand that again as a nation. And we need to recognize again that we're not each other's enemies. We should learn how to discuss things intelligently with the facts on the table. And throw out all this ideology that has nothing to do with facts and only to do with feelings. Because feelings change all the time. Facts do not. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. And remember to subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Tell your friends about it, because what we're trying to do is spread common sense. We want common sense to be common once again. And you're a big part of helping us make that come true. And remember the cornerstones: faith, liberty, community, and life. See you next week.